So it's a common objection. Doesn't Christianity oppose reason? People seem to think religion and irrationality go together. Faith versus reason. And the atheist can often take a higher ground. I'm the free thinker, the courageous one who follows reason wherever it takes me. There's various points in history that people can point to. Stories about the dark ages of church control in Europe, the dark ages. Or stories about people like Galileo, who was persecuted by the church for his scientific discoveries. The various statistics can be quoted to make the point that most rational people and scientific people are irreligious. It's a pretty common objection, but I want to say that it's not obviously true that Christianity opposes reason. I mean, think about it. Here we are at a tertiary institution, and there's a group organised by Christians to discuss significant philosophical topics. There are groups like this and universities all around Australia and the world. Historically, many of the universities and schools of the world were founded by Christians. Isn't that interesting? Many of the libraries of the world founded by Christians. Many of the philosophers, scientists, judges, historians, scientists have been and still are Christians. In many faculties of this university and others around the world, you'll find devout Christians investigating their science, their history, their medicine, their law, and so on. You go to the theology sections and philosophy sections here of the Morris Miller Library, and you'll find book after book after book of rich, deep intellectual reflection from centuries and centuries and centuries, Christians engaging with the highest and most sophisticated thought of their day. Christians are book writers, thinkers, educators, learners, investigators. It's not obviously true. And yet the objection persists. Maybe the objection is putting a finger on a weakness of Christianity. Is there a tendency that Christianity has to slip into irrationality? Maybe that's it. Or maybe stronger, perhaps when Christians write these books and found these universities, they are being inconsistent. They're doing these things almost in spite of their religion. And that the most authentic Christianity is ignorant. Here are five versions of the objection I want to touch on briefly today, and then we can take any questions you might have as well. The five versions of this objection that I've been able to sort of reflect upon are, number one, all the smartest people aren't Christian. Number two, Christianity promotes irrational beliefs. Number three, it manifests a superstitious outlook. Number four, it discourages rational inquiry. And number five, the infallible authority of the Bible necessarily undermines reason. Smart people aren't Christians. Christians believe irrational things. Christians are superstitious. They discourage rational inquiry. And the authority of the Bible undermines reason. Number one, then. Smartest people aren't Christians. In the very early centuries of the church, this was a common objection from the Roman and Greek philosophers who looked on the Christians. They said Christianity is a religion, no offence, but for women, for children, and for slaves. In other words, they're saying fools are Christian. And in variations, that's continued on through the various centuries. In his book, The God Delusion, Richard Dawkins quotes a 1998 study that shows that among the elite National Academy of Sciences, the elite scientists in America, only 7% believe in a personal God who communicates with people and answers prayers. Therefore, if you're elite in your rational thinking, that's hostile to Christian belief. How might I respond? Well, number one, with that statistic, there's a whole lot of questions that's got to be asked about it. It only touches on a very narrow type of religious belief, belief in a personal God who answers prayer. There could be a much larger percentage of those in the NAS who have other forms of religious belief. Moreover, with any kind of poll, you've got to ask, what was the wording of the question? And could the wording of the question generated a higher degree of no answers because someone just... Have you ever done that with a quiz where you go, I don't quite know what you're asking, and if you mean this, then yes, but maybe you mean that, then no? Is it really a representative study? 1998, the National Academy of Sciences. Is that a general tendency for all highly trained scientific people? The exact same question was asked in 1914... of the same group, and the answer was 27% believed, not 7%, but 27% believed in a personal God. So Are people necessarily more rational in 1998 than 1914? Or has the study simply shown a snapshot of elite American scientists at the end of the 20th century? Other studies that have done similar things about religious belief in science faculties produce much higher results of religious belief, up to about 50% of people holding to some form of religious belief. So there's just lots of questions about a single study that can be quoted to go, what does this really establish? Is it really establishing a necessary relationship between high-level intelligence and scientific training and irreligion? Or is it more a kind of a correlation that's not really one causes the other, you know? Second response. It's possible, I don't know, but it's possible that extremely smart people have a tendency to skepticism and free thinking and a high degree of trust in their own reason. That's possible. That is, you may well find a correlation between extremely intelligent people and TV watching habits. They have a tendency to watch little TV or a lot of TV. This doesn't necessarily prove that it's extremely rational to not watch much TV or to watch much TV. But it could just be a tendency that happens to go along with human beings with high degrees of intelligence. It doesn't necessarily prove something one way or the other. It could be that extremely elite intelligent people are just more inclined to believe unorthodox, free-thinking, eccentric beliefs of all kinds, including irreligion. That's possible. Perhaps a bit more possible is that the more smart you are and the more you know you're smart, there is a risk of pride and self-sufficiency and a reaction against religion, which might be unwelcome, uncomfortable, unattractive, some greater being. Why would I want to trust in something like that? Possibly. Number three, and I think this is the main thing, there are so many sociological and historical reasons for why different people have different beliefs. Yeah, there's a whole mix of things. Elite scientists in the United States in the late 20th century believe things for a range of cultural, historical, and social factors. They may well bring their lack of religion to their scientific studies. They may well have, but through peer groups, lack of religious belief reinforced during the time of their studies and postgraduate studies. It doesn't necessarily, we can't assume because someone is an elite in a field of study that they are therefore consistently rational and only form all their beliefs based on that same rational rigour in every other area of their lives. People are just way more complicated than that. So many things feed into our beliefs. And so demographic data on its own is just a very thin basis to make a case, really. It's very hard to prove anything of much interest out of these kind of statistics on their own. Currently, at the moment, this group of very smart people happen to be dramatically irreligious. Therefore, I don't know. So the first objection, smart people are irreligious. Well, I don't know, are they always? Maybe at the moment, necessarily? It's a little hard to say much from that kind of claim. Number two then, Christianity though does encourage you to believe ridiculous things, right? It encourages you to have irrational beliefs. The Trinity, miracles, the incarnation of God in human form. If God's so powerful, why doesn't he stop evil in the world? Surely, any smart person who thinks about these bizarre things long enough will realise they're ridiculous. Even in the early centuries, there were variations of this. In the first and second centuries particularly, the Greek thinkers found the idea of a physical resurrection and a physical afterlife bizarre, and every intelligent person knows people don't rise from the dead. So there's variations of this again through the centuries. Often people say the problem is you guys, you religious types, is that you encounter these objections and you respond to it by saying, oh, it's a mystery. That's the cop-out, religious cop-out. Call it a mystery and you can believe whatever ridiculous stuff you like. What can we say by way of response? Well, number one, the church has consistently adopted views that are difficult to believe. The church has consistently adopted views, like the Trinity, that are difficult to believe. I want to say, though, that that's not because they love irrationality and so the more ridiculous the better. Anyone can think of a more ridiculous idea? You do? Okay, we like that one. It's not so much that. as because if you go back and read some of these conversations and debates and discussions, it's rather that people are going, we're not just making up a religion that's easy to believe. We're genuinely trying to understand what best accounts for our religious scriptures, our religious view of the world, our encounter with Jesus. And so that means that even if we adopt something that's hard to believe, it's because we are convinced it's the best explanation of our scriptures and of the world. It wasn't just a favour of irrationality, but it was actually we have the option of adopting easier views within our religious community. Easier views are suggested to us, and yet we've chosen harder ones because we're persuaded of their greater coherence. To put this simply, most of the people that criticise some of these theological beliefs have never spent much time investigating them deeply. Which is ironic, because that's a form of ignorance itself. To sit on the sidelines, hear a thin description of the Trinity and laugh at it is actually quite an uneducated and ignorant thing to do. Those who have taken the time to think more deeply and carefully and thoughtfully may still disagree, but have a much higher degree of respect for these kinds of things. Second response. There are different types of mystery, or different types of appeals to mystery. If Jordan said 1 plus 1 equals 3, and we all went, no, it doesn't. And he went, no, it totally does. And you go, well, how can you prove that 1 plus 1 equals 3? It equals 2, dude. And he said, man, it's a mystery. It's a mystery. That's an illegitimate appeal to mystery. On what ground is there anything mysterious about this blatantly unmathematical declaration, right? If, on the other hand, Jordan began to explain to us the intricacies of quarks and quantum particles and how they both are and not are, and how light is a wave and a particle at the same time, you know, and we went, you know, this affects this across the universe, I think, and we said, that's, how do you explain that? And he said, it's a mystery.
It is to me.
Yeah, to some extent it is, right? And why is it mysterious to us? Because when things are extremely enormous or extremely small, they behave differently to most of the stuff we interact with, all the in-between Goldilocks stuff, right? And that's why there's a legitimate place for mystery, because what is obvious to us when things are regular size, it's legitimate to imagine that possibly when they're extremely tiny or extremely massive, they'll behave in a way that might seem surprising to us. Do you see what I mean? And so in the same way, when you deal with a transcendent God beyond space and time, a creator of all things utterly unlike anything else in the universe, is it possible that such a being might have a relationship to personhood and being that would make the Trinity possible, which it wouldn't be possible for normal, regular Newtonian things like us? You know, is it possible that his relationship to cause and effect and time and predestination is such that we can't get our head around it? Yeah. It's a legitimate appeal to mystery. Third response to this objection. When you encounter the biggest questions of the universe, it's right to have a degree of humility and caution. It's right to say, as best as we know at the moment, as best as we understand at the moment, this is the case. Well, it's good to realise the limits of human reason and the bias that we all have, the prejudice we all have a tendency to. And in that context, I think Christianity gives you a great intellectual virtue. A great intellectual virtue of humility that makes you both more rational and more moral with your rational investigations and endeavours. That's why we read this passage from Romans, this quite confronting passage. Who are you, O human being, to talk back to God? Shall what is formed say to the one who formed it, why did you do this or that? That's quite offensive, really. What are you telling me off for? But it's quite a healthy thing to have a sense of perspective. Who am I? Who are we? You know? Later on in that same book in the Bible, Romans chapter 11, there's a little song that sings, oh, the depths of the riches of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. How unsearchable his judgments. His paths are beyond tracing out. Who's known the mind of the Lord? Who's been his counsellor? It's right to have a degree of humility about the limits of what we can know, yeah? About how sensible our common sense is, about how far our reason can reach, yeah? There's a degree to which it's healthy to when we hit things beyond us, to be humbled by that, yeah? So objection one, smart people aren't Christians. Well, I think that's a very questionable, problematic assertion. Objection number two, Christians believe irrational things. Well, there's a legitimate kind of appeal to mystery and a healthy intellectual humility. Objection three, Christianity manifests a sort of superstitious outlook. What does superstition mean, really? Well, in some ways, it's just the insult word for religion. You know, religion you don't like, you just call it, you know, a superstition. But maybe if we had to kind of drill down into it, I think we'd say a superstitious approach to religion is a kind of bric-a-brac collage approach to collecting ideas and practices under a general tendency to try and explain and try and protect our experience in the world. A kind of collection together of all sorts of ideas and practices to explain and protect in an uncertain and mysterious world. It's a kind of magical approach to religion and to life, where I there's all sorts of forces out there, and it's probably best to fear everything and believe everything, and then maybe I'll be okay. Something like that, yeah? It tends to be associated with folk religion. That is, just sort of everyday sort of rule of thumb, not sort of particularly intellectual, but more knee-jerk kind of traditional religion. It tends towards various totems to collect, spells or prayers to pray, people or places to protect and get good luck or healing or knowledge, ceremonies to practice, rituals to undergo, and so on. In the first few centuries of Christianity, a Roman leader, Tacitus, called Christianity a deadly superstition. A deadly superstition. And that was part of a general opposition to Christianity by the Romans. They saw it as threatening to established religions, legal religions. They saw it as emotionalistic, bizarre, eccentric, unstable. But mainly for them, the critique was not only that it was irrational, but that it was antisocial. You Christians aren't joining in with our established religion, therefore you're superstitious. They treated Druids and other kinds of pagan religions similarly. If you're on the outside of our established religious temples, you're a superstition. In the Western world, in the Enlightenment of the 17th century, the atheist Enlightenment thinkers began to talk about all religious belief, really, as irrational, gullible, primitive, superstitious, by contrast to reason and atheism and civilization and intelligence. Richard Dawkins describes religion as the first and the worst explanation of the way the world works. First and the worst. Primitive and inaccurate, so why stick with it? Is Christian religion superstitious? Well, number one, all human beings can tend towards superstition. We all can. We try and make sense of our world. We try and survive in it. We look for patterns and look for ways to get good luck or a good night's sleep or whatever it is. Religion does this. And so Christians, some of you might be superstitious Christians. You get a story on Facebook, you kind of half read it, sounds nice, makes you feel good, you share it on, you don't fact check it. It just reinforces your view of the world. Oh, I heard a story about someone's best friend's sister's boyfriend's brother's girlfriend who prayed in this way and got this blessing. Must be true, because I like the idea. Yeah, maybe some of you are Christians like that. I've definitely known Christians like that. A lazy attitude to truth, a superstitious approach. Atheists can do that too. There's a certain kind of science mythology that talks of evolution and genes and psychology without any real evidence behind it, but says, the reason humans do this is because a long time ago in the caves, we couldn't bake bread, and therefore we can't eat bread because, or whatever it is. You know, long time ago, the man had to go out hunting and the woman had to do that, which is therefore why men are bad at looking in fridges. And there's not necessarily any actual evidence, but you just say caveman, evolution, psychology, genes, and it sounds pretty good. Must be true, that kind of thing. And it really is nonsense. It's a just-so story, but just sounds good. So atheists can do it. We can all be superstitious at times, yeah? But mature Christianity, the second response to this is, mature Christianity, I want to put to you, is actually hostile to superstition. And I think demonstrably so. If we had more time, we could see in history, at times when Christianity has been at its most mature, superstitious behaviours have actually declined in popularity. perhaps some views are very inclined to superstition. I would say perhaps more animistic and polytheistic religions tend towards superstition more naturally, whereas monotheism at its most mature tends not to have that kind of magical view of the world. I want to suggest that mature Christianity doesn't encourage it. It actually drifts away from it. Listen, for example, to this passage from 1 Timothy chapter 1. 1 Timothy chapter 1 in the Bible. I urge you to stay in Ephesus so you may command certain people not to devote themselves to myths and endless genealogies. Such things promote controversial speculations rather than God's work. Or again, from Colossians chapter 2 in the New Testament of the Bible. Don't let anyone who delights in false humility and the worship of angels disqualify you. Such a person goes into great detail about what they've seen. They're puffed up with idle notions by their unspiritual mind. They've lost connection with the head from whom the whole body grows. It's actually unspiritual to be overly concerned with angelic experiences and various kind of religious specifics. When you see Roman Catholicism at its most fascinated with relics and saints, or Pentecostal miracle preachers at their most bizarre, you're really seeing a kind of folk Christianity that is behaving more like a pagan religion than like mature Christian religion at all. So I don't think it's really fair to say that Christianity itself is superstitious. But perhaps the fourth objection is closer to home, that Christianity is has a bad attitude to rationality. It undermines rationality. Faith versus reason. Religion versus science. The 17th century, I've already mentioned, the Enlightenment was a time in Western culture where a strong reaction against religion came into fashion in the intellectual world. And it told a story of history like this. Once upon a time, there were the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages. Ages ruled by the church, opposed to reason, suffocating in study and learning. People fought bloody wars, like the story of Gulliver's Travels, where one group cared about which side of the egg you cut off when you boil an egg and eat it. And they fight these ridiculous wars over silly things like that. But then a brave, handsome prince called the Enlightenment came along. And the Enlightenment slayed the dragon of the Roman Catholic Church with its traditions and institutions and superstition and opposition to reason and began a new path for humanity based on science, reason, equality, liberty, fraternity. Is this correct? Well, first, this whole story about the Dark Ages is, as a way of describing the medieval period, is now historically inaccurate. And outdated. The so-called Dark Ages, insofar as the early medieval period was dark, it was for political reasons, economic reasons, not religious ones. The Roman Empire collapsed, and so civilization with it, and plagues, and wars, and famines brought upheaval. These explanations, much more than Christian religion, led to any darkness that may have been there. Moreover, the medieval period went on to be not very dark at all. As David Bentley Hart writes, by the late Middle Ages, from the 7th to the 8th century onwards, were marked by a dynamism in arts, scholarship, engineering, architecture, law, philosophy and science. One of the things which kept learning light and enlightened during the medieval period, again, Bentley Hart writes, Western Christendom didn't lose Greek and Roman knowledge because of censorship. In fact, not only did they not burn pagan texts, but the literary remains of the ancient Roman world were hoarded and jealously guarded in monastic libraries, even as the Western Roman world was disintegrating. The church actually helped preserve ancient learning. The Enlightenment, when it came after and hand in hand with a very religious movement called the Protestant Reformation. And the Protestant Reformation was equally concerned with reason, critique, learning, study, and it was deeply religious and Christian. And as for the world the Enlightenment brought, well, history goes on to show that in the 18th to the 20th centuries, we saw some of the bloodiest and most vast of wars fought in the name of secular ideologies and nationalism. And so it's not as if the Enlightenment brought this great happy world of freedom and peace. It just brought new things for people to fight for. So the Dark Ages story is really kind of an outdated and inaccurate one. But secondly, I want to put to you that Christianity in its mature form encourages investigation and learning because It's a literate religion. I talked about books at the beginning of this session, and there's a reason for that. Christians believe in a God who speaks, who has spoken his words written down in the Bible. And so Christian religion is learning. Christian conversion is being persuaded. Christian discipleship is learning and thinking. In fact, the word disciple means student. There's even a heritage in the Christian religion of doubt and questioning that goes right back to the Jewish book of Job and Ecclesiastes through to the existential Christian writers of the last 100 years. Christianity encourages investigation because it is literate. Third response, Christianity encourages questioning and investigation because of its view of the world. Because of its view of the world. There's three things that go together in the way Christians look at the world that makes Christian, mature Christianity very inclined towards learning and investigation. Christian religion teaches the world is ordered and understandable. So I should expect to be able to understand the world. Secondly, the Christian world sees the world as good. It matters. God made it. It's real. It's good. And so actually it's glorifying to God to get to know the world. Yeah? There's a reason to be interested in it. There's a reason to expect it to be understandable. And thirdly, the world is freely made by God. And so there's an unpredictability. I don't know what it's like unless I go and find out. I can't just meditate and know what the world will be like. I can't just work from philosophical first principles and expect to be correct, because the world could have been made differently. The free creation of the world, the goodness of the world, and the order of the world creates a philosophical framework which is very conducive to the scientific method. And so it's no surprise, really, that it was in the Western world, amongst Christian and Islamic religion, that modern science grew, rather than in worlds dominated by more Eastern or pagan worldviews. There are probably political and economic factors too, but it's not surprising given how conducive that philosophical framework is. Christianity doesn't promote or celebrate an irrational, non-questioning, non-investigating view of the world. It promotes, motivates, grounds it. It actually is in favour of it. And when you read Christian scientists writing, and historically read Christian scientists writing, you read them speaking very freely, spontaneously and regularly about how their religion is fed into and influenced by their learning. But perhaps your question is really the final one that we'll touch on before we take questions. And that is, sure. Okay, maybe there are a lot of smart people who are Christians, okay? And maybe your weird ideas have some kind of logic to them, sure. Granted, you're not superstitious, and granted that you like the idea of being rational, and your religion tells you you should be, okay, you still got a problem. You Christians still have an issue, and that is that you've got this other authority, your Bible, that you think is without error. And so you have to believe it, no matter what reason and science tells you. That's a problem. A competing authority that undermines reason. Yeah? It's a tricky reality, right? And we see it perhaps, or at least so it's said, in the story of Galileo. 17th century, Galileo Galilei provided evidence that the sun is at the centre of the solar system. Heliocentrism, or Copernican view of the solar system. Rather than the earth is being at the centre, the Aristotelian Ptolemaic view. Evidence such as moons around Jupiter, the phases of Venus, and so forth. He confronted then the traditional views that were supported by the Roman Catholic Church and the scientists of the day, and that caused great controversy. In fact, the conservative scientists refused to look through his telescope. He was put on trial for this claim by the Roman Catholic Church, threatened into recanting, and spent the rest of his life under house arrest. Well, isn't that just one example? We could give others of the fact that believing this Bible forces you then to oppose the best of human learning, this ancient, flawed text. First response. In these conversations, it's important to realise, including Galileo's story, that the conversation was much more complex. It was a question of what is the Bible saying and what is the science saying, and does the science help me reread the Bible better, and does the Bible help me check the science carefully? See, it's more of a loop or a spiral. When I look at the world and it seems different to what I thought the Bible was saying, it forces me to look back and see whether I read the Bible well or not. And as I read the Bible, it might force me to then ask questions about whether the science has been overinterpreted or is accurate yet. Galileo himself saw himself as a Christian, as a Catholic, as a Bible reader. And he actually wrote at great length, probably it annoyed people all the more that he did this, about how to interpret the Bible well. He quoted Augustine saying, "If anyone shall set the authority of the Bible against reason, he doesn't know what he's doing." What instead he's doing is not critiquing the Bible, but what he has found in himself and imagines to be in the Bible. In other words, Galileo was saying, you're over-reading the Bible, making it say more than it actually says. When it speaks about the experience of the sun rising and setting, I mean, we still talk that way, don't we? Now, when I say the sun rises and the sun sets, and you went, "Ah, you stupid Christian, you believe the earth is still and the sun moves," I'd go, no, you've read more into what I'm saying than I'm saying. And more or less that was what Galileo was saying in the 17th century as well. So it's much more complex. The Bible could be wrong, or I could just have read it wrong. The science could be wrong, or it could just be overinterpreted. Do you see? Second response to this objection. Human beings are kind of understandably conservative. There's a conservativeness and traditionalism that's not just religious, but kind of human and kind of normal. It's what stops us being gullible. When an atheist encounters evidence for ghosts or demons, their first reaction is not, "Well, that's what the evidence says, I guess I believe in ghosts now." No, their reaction, a bit like the old X-Files TV show, is, "There's got to be a rational explanation for this, Mulder. There's got to be some way that we can explain what seems to be supernatural. It can't be." Do you see? And so we all have an instinct to go, "Oh, I don't know." And so even in the day of Galileo, his views were new, radical, and not perfectly proven yet. Perhaps it was understandable for a bunch of people to go, "Yeah, I don't know." Part of the issue with the trial of Galileo is that it wasn't really between a Catholic and an atheist. It was Catholics debating with each other the established powers and traditions against a new thinker. But it was more than that, really. It wasn't really even a debate particularly about religion, but it was a debate between particular types of science itself. And so one historian on science, Kirsten Burkett, observes that really the story of Galileo doesn't really show you a story of Christianity versus science. It does demonstrate what happens when old science is challenged by the new theory of science. Many of those in the scientific establishment react with scepticism and dismiss the new challenger. Galileo's story is really about Aristotelian science clashing with modern mathematical science. Galileo fought for a new science against the entrenched conservatism of an intellectual system which had been accepted for centuries, and against individuals in the universities who were not at all willing to have their jobs and their professional reputations challenged. The main lessons we learn from Galileo, Burkett writes, are about how science changes, not particularly about religion at all. Of course, Galileo didn't do himself any favours by being such a sarcastic and abrasive character, but that's a whole other story. Third, Christianity actually has good reason to critique traditionalism and conservatism. I've mentioned the Protestant Reformation. That was one of the great things about the Protestant Reformation. It critiqued overly conservative Catholic tradition, critiqued it, urged for truth in God's word to test and always reform established traditional beliefs. And it's interesting to note that Galileo's findings caused no controversies amongst the Reformation churches. That's an interesting thing, isn't it? Fourth, you can never escape competing authorities. Science itself has its own traditions and communities. There's very few people ever who reprove and re-establish every scientific finding. No, you build on the traditions of the scientists who've gone before you. Even if you did reprove them all, part of the power of the scientific method is a community of people over time, testing and retesting and re-establishing and re-establishing. Yeah? Scientific beliefs themselves don't develop in a simple, rational world. Universities have funding and politics. Ideas take time and often surge ahead. when they're ready, perhaps after decades or even centuries of being nibbled around the edges. It doesn't make science wrong. It just makes it imperfect, like everything we humans undertake. Fifth, we need an authority to hold authority and reason in tension. And that's what Christians seek to do, to probe, to test, to maybe for a season go, I'm not sure if this is true, there might be more evidence coming. For now, I'll say, I don't know, but I'll be open to change later. And there is always the possibility of apostasy, of going, you know what, I am convinced Christianity is rubbish, and so leave your religion. But Christianity urges and commends open persuasion, intelligent conversion. It praises, in Acts 17, the Berean Jews who, it says, were of more noble character than the Thessalonians, for they received the message about Jesus with eagerness and examined the scriptures every day to see if what Paul said was true. It's noble of them to have examined and tested to see if it's true. And I have several other passages here, but for the sake of time, I'll just conclude with this. What we're wanting to invite you to do when we talk to you about Christian religion is not switch off your mind, enjoy our community, be swashed over with an experience, and just believe it. That's not what we want. We want to persuade and discuss with you. We want to win you over to the truth that we believe is in Jesus. And once you believe, we don't want you to just sit down, shut up, and swallow whatever you're told. We want you to listen, reflect, discern, question, and probe. We see no use in blind, irrational, unthinking faith. We want intelligent, genuine, and sincere faith. And we want that to characterise your whole life, not just your religious life, but your whole intellectual life, that you honour truth wherever it's found. I'll pause there, maybe say a brief prayer for those who would like to pray along with me, and then we can take questions for 5 to 10 minutes. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for this good, ordered, and amazing world you've made. We pray that you help us know more about it as we study and as we learn during the rest of our lives. And we pray that you give us integrity in all our learning and thinking, including in our religious investigations. Pray for those who are interested, curious, half-interested, doubting, asking questions about these things, that you help them think and explore and find the answers to their questions about the biggest questions of life. In Jesus' name, amen. Now, before you maybe get your form questions, I don't know if you had any closing things you had to say, Jordan, or you're kind of done?
Just about the events again.
I can just say that again? Yep. If you need to go, feel free to go, but we'll go through till 2 o'clock. Jordan just was going to repeat again the invite tonight, 7 o'clock at Stanley Burberry, how the church is better and worse than you imagined. It should be a really fascinating time. And then also on Thursday night, 7 o'clock or 6 o'clock for free tacos with the Taco Truck, looking at the topic of the Crusades in particular. Both of those will be on our Facebook page and on our website. All right, are there any questions?
Christianity 1A, which is the course, if you haven't heard about it, looking through a few pieces in the Bible, just helping to navigate through that and some of the core beliefs. And that's actually on straight after this, so if you're really keen, just sit here.
But if this time doesn't work and you're still curious in that, you can chat to chat to anyone with the thing around their neck or with me, or again, you can find information about 1A in a sign-up expression of interest form on the website. Are there any questions, comments people want to ask or make?
If you were talking to an atheist and they were talking about how Christianity opposes reason, do you think that you would just defend Christianity, or would you also kind of make kind of movements towards saying that there are parts of atheism that oppose reason? Would you go into and like looking at
holding them. Yeah, I think any conversation is both, isn't it? Any conversation is both defending and justifying, but also, in a sense, part of justifying this view is showing how unsatisfactory other views might be. Yeah, yeah. And so in the case of, I mean, an advantage of religion over no religion whatsoever has to do with what is the ground and cause and origin of all being. So where does everything come from? And even if that was, it could possibly be the mystery of somehow creation out of nothing, but that's then becomes pretty leap of faith territory, which is fine, but it's worth going, well, you've then got a leap of faith too. Your leap of faith is somehow something came out of nothing. Or if everything is eternal, then Christian religion asks, but what is the ground of being? So this is kind of a contingency argument question, but God is not only the cause of all that is, but an eternal ground of all that is, a kind of a basis of all being. So there'd be questions around that, questions around ethics and morality, that if someone wants to be an atheist but also hold that there actually are right and wrong things, atheists can have morals. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it's hard to have a philosophical basis for your morality if you're an atheist. So that's an issue, a moral issue with atheism. And there also is, in a sense, whereas religion gives you a sense to believe that my reason can accurately see the world, atheism doesn't quite have an explanation for that. How do I know that what I'm seeing of the world is a true representation of the world and not merely a passable one for my animal being to kind of survive in? You know, there could be all sorts of distortions and confusions that happily enough mean that I still get food and shelter and clothing, but might actually be totally way off and inaccurate. You know, I don't know that what I'm seeing of the world is a true reflection of the actual world, whereas if there's a creator who has given a coherent ground for truth, I can know that clearer. Yeah, so there are things like that I could probe, and as well as asking, you know, what is our explanation of Jesus and the birth of the Christian church and so on? Yes, so yeah, we go in both directions, I expect.
How do you strike a balance between...
You look so wise in that big armchair. Yes, and the, yeah.
So, like, between like questioning and being sceptic about, you know, the Christian beliefs and other things that Christians might say or you might read, how do you strike a balance between that and between sort of accepting, like, Christian doctrine and the Bible as and, you know, living it out?
Yeah, there's a great quote from a popular religious writer, C.S. Lewis, who says that if you see through everything, and if everything is see-through, then in the end that's the same as seeing nothing at all. And that's the risk of scepticism, you know, and in a sense I touched on that with the possibility that there could be a tendency amongst elite intellectuals to be not proportionally and rationally sceptical, but actually disproportionately sceptical, almost. You know, and so that's a tricky thing to hold in balance, to go, I need to believe in enough and have enough credulity, if you like, to actually function well and fruitfully in the world. How you figure that out, I don't think there's like an equation for that. but I think that's a thing to keep asking. Have I slid into just like an utter cynicism and scepticism where, you know, nothing is true, or am I kind of working in that area of beyond reasonable doubt, if you like? Yeah. And that's partly knowing yourself as well, because I think some of us can have a massively volatile intellectual life where we just swing back and forth, just like some people have that with their relational life, and they're always in crisis with friends and family and romantic partners, and, you know, they need a bit more stability, which we might say, you just need to stop overthinking things, we say. Now, we're not saying be less rational, but we're saying your animal experience of your thinking is in overdrive and it's actually distorting you. By overthinking, you're actually seeing things less clearly. And so that's partly...
The other way as well, though, right? So not being rational enough.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So yeah, yeah. So you've got to dial that in somewhere in there. And I suspect that's a spectrum rather than one sweet spot. That there's a spectrum of people who, some people might be more credulous, some people are a little more sceptical, but somewhere in there, there's a happy medium where you're still not ridiculously gullible, nor despairingly cynical. Yeah. And probably in this room, most of us, I think, would be somewhere in that Goldilocks zone, while there being some of us more gullible or more cynical in that spectrum. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm here as someone who just wants to sort of understand how people think.
Yeah, cool.
I was wondering, do you reckon, like, on a personal level, you could almost say that your faith or your belief in Christianity, whatever, is almost like a null hypothesis? It's kind of like, you know, this is what I'm going with until proven otherwise, or you know, it develops?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. Yeah, I guess... In a sense, we all have a starting point in terms of how we look at the world and what things are kind of givens before we, you know, so most of us work from the given that the external world exists and the past exists and there's some continuity of us. You know, we sort of begin with some things that we go, look, I'll just start with that. And yeah, for religious people, God is like a starting point assumption thing. It's not like we begin and go, you know, imagine I just opened my eyes for the first time. What can I know about, you know, we don't so much begin there as we go, let's begin, we find ourselves in the world with these relationships, with a sense that God's in the world. Yep. And then Christians abandon, or religious people abandon their religion when they hit sufficient points of tension to go, yeah, that's no longer working for, you know, that doesn't, there's so many things I'm experiencing and thinking that don't account for what I've believed up to this point. It's starting to crack.
Then sometimes it's the other way that, so like as you were saying, we all come with that existing belief, and so you can come with an existing atheistic belief, and then some things that you see in the Bible or in the world make you update that as well.
Yeah.
In the same fashion.
Yes, yeah, that's good. Yeah. And that's 2 o'clock. Unless you've got a 14-second question. Really great to have you guys with us. The audio will be up online if you'd like to revisit in any way. You're welcome to stay and join in this 1A discussion with Jordan, who's hosting that, looking at part of the Bible. Or, again, come and join us tonight, Thursday night, or stalk us a little more. We have a section on our website, actually. If you click on sermons, there's a section called Frequently Asked Questions, which has a lot of these lunchtime sessions that ask kind of just these kind of abstract questions about religious reasons. So you could go to the FAQ section and get questions about who was Jesus or does Christianity disprove suffering, all those kind of things. So we'll finish off there. Have a great afternoon.